Could you imagine never having to worry about shooting in low light, having the ability to capture amazing detail in next to no light from a tiny sensor? Could you imagine a camera that chooses to capture an image half a second before you press the shutter button, because that's when your subject was looking their best and not blinking? Could you imagine a camera that takes a dozen photos at different exposures instantaneously to then merge them together into a single image with incredible dynamic range, allowing you to see that beautiful sunset over the ocean and still get detail in your child's face, despite them being in the shade? Well, guess what? There is a camera that does all that. It scans what you're taking a photo of using machine learning, and with advanced algorithms, provides the best image settings in a process called computational photography. Computational photography is going to transform the photography industry as a whole. And it sounds incredible, right? Now, if you want to get your hands on this level of technology, I know that you do. And guess what, my photo friends? If you have taken a photo using your cell phone over the past 3 or 4 years, you have. You have used computational photography. And today, we're going to dive deeper into the power of computational photography and also why you don't have it in your real camera. So I'm excited for this. I am your host, Raymond Hatfield. I'm a wedding photographer. And one of the questions that I get asked that I see most often in the beginner photography podcast community is, how come the photos that I take with my iPhone look way better than the photos that I take with my real camera? And I'm sure that you have felt the same way. I know that early on in photography, you know, I felt the same way. Often it was kind of just a still trying to figure out my settings. But today, the iPhone offers incredibly easy, and I guess just all mobile photography, offers an incredibly easy way to take really good-looking photos. So the answer to that question, why do the photos that I take with my iPhone look better than the photos that I take with my real camera, is, well, it's the future of photography. And that is exactly what we're going to talk about today. Now, computational photography uses what's called machine learning to create an image that simply isn't possible due to the physical or technical limitations of a camera sensor or lens element. So if you have taken an HDR image, you'll be, I think, familiar with this concept. If you don't know, HDR stands for High Dynamic Range. And dynamic range is the difference between the brightest bright of your scene, of your photo, and the darkest dark. And the difference between the two is dynamic range, right? It's how much your camera sensor can capture, how much light intensity your camera sensor can capture. So if you have ever taken a photo of a sunset, like I talked about earlier, and the sunset looked great, but everything else was totally underexposed, maybe trees in the foreground, rocks, a person totally underexposed, silhouetted, you couldn't see anything that except for the sunset. That is because your camera sensor does not have enough dynamic range to capture the entire scene. And that is a physical limitation of your camera's sensor. So to capture a photo with high dynamic range, and high is not a precise value, it's just more than what your camera is going to come with, or not come with, but be equipped to handle, right? So anything more than what your camera can handle on its own is considered high dynamic range. So, you know, I think one of the first times that I tried high dynamic range was probably like 12 years ago. And the photos that I was able to create using multiple exposures and this whole technique that I'm going to tell you about, cameras today can do that in just a single exposure. So it continues to grow. So again, high dynamic range is not a set value. It's just more than what your camera is capable of capturing on its own. So to capture a photo with high dynamic range, you would need a minimum of two photos. One photo that is technically overexposed and one photo that is technically underexposed. And then you would take those two photos and then use some sort of computer program to stitch them together. And hopefully your camera's on a tripod, because if there's any sort of image shake, then the program that you use is going to cause ghosting in the stitched image. It's not good. It's unacceptable. But what the computer program does is it takes the highlights, the brightest parts of the dark photo, the photo that's underexposed, and then it takes the shadow detail, or the darkest parts of the photo that is overexposed, right? And then it blends them together to create an image with more range in light, more dynamic range. And this may seem complex, but it can be easily done with just, you know, literally the click of one button in both Lightroom and Photoshop. It's super easy to do today. But what the computer program does, right, either Lightroom, Photoshop, whatever other program you want to use to create an HDR image, it creates an image that is just simply not possible, like I said, due to the physical limitations of your camera sensor or your camera's lens. And I think that where we're at today, everybody's probably familiar with the quote-unquote, you know, the auto button that enhances an image that you've taken. You load it up into Lightroom. Lightroom has one. You just click auto, maybe, you know, brighten it up a little bit, you know, change the contrast a little bit, maybe shift the colors. That is a form of computational photography where software analyzes the light of an image using the histogram, and then it kind of evens everything out a bit. As I said earlier, it brings down the highlights, maybe it brings up the shadows. That's about it. Now, with the explosion of mobile photography, camera makers quickly started making better small sensors and better lenses. That's the progression of how things go. But pretty quickly, camera makers ran into a wall real quick because of the physical limitations of how small the camera has to be made. Because it has to fit into a small phone, a thin phone. But, you know, we had to figure that out because there are things like bokeh or the out-of-focus background, right, that everybody loves so much. That's why you buy the Nifty 50, and then for like a month, you just shoot everything at 1.8 so that you can get that out-of-focus background. And that out-of-focus background is a result of the physical factors, like the size of your image sensor, your focal length, and your subject's distance to camera. So we couldn't do anything more with physical size of the sensor or focal length, because again, it had to all fit within a very limited space of a cell phone, you know, and with every new cell phone, there's less and less. They get thinner and thinner. So it became really important for computer programmers to figure out new ways to take better photos than what we had been doing for the past 140 years. It's really interesting stuff. I hope that you're holding on to this, because I think it's pretty interesting. But this led computer scientists to start working on computational photography, but not done after the fact, like with an HDR image where you as the photographer have to take multiple exposures, and then you as the photographer have to bring those files onto your computer and then load them up into a program that can do what you want it to do. But computer scientists had to start working on computational photography in real time to create better photos, rather than you having to do it manually after the capture. Think about that for a second. Like what's that game that we play as kids, like Leapfrog or whatever? Like that's what we did, but times 100. With computers, we were able to do things with photos that we had never been able to do before, easier than ever before, faster than ever before. And all of a sudden, with computational photography, where now it's just happening in real time. It's to the point to where I'm assuming that a lot of you listening to this didn't even realize that this was happening in the background of your phone whenever you would go to take a photo. Because over time, photos just kind of got better and better and better. But it didn't seem like there was one like massive jump. It just kind of got to the point to where, oh, here we are today. Like these are just phenomenal photos. Massive stuff. But really, the tech inside of the cameras hasn't changed a ton in the past 5 or 6 years. The biggest change has come from computational photography, which is really exciting because then that, you know, opens up the door for, well, what could happen if we were able to, you know, bring computational photography to older DSLR cameras, right? Because they still have larger sensors. They perform better than cell phones. So we'd be able to take phenomenal photos. Hey, Raymond here. If you're sometimes baffled by which camera settings to use, then I've got just the thing for you. My free guide, Picture Perfect Camera Settings. It's a fantastic starting point for anybody eager to understand the basics of camera settings in various shooting scenarios. And it's tailored to beginners who want to get out of auto mode, providing clear, easy-to-follow suggestions on where to start with your settings. So whether you're capturing a stunning landscape or a family portrait, Picture Perfect Camera Settings will help you to get off of automatic mode and explore the possibilities your camera offers. Remember, mastering photography settings is a journey, and this guide is your first step and the perfect resource to guide you towards finding the right settings for your style. So grab your copy today at perfectcamerasettings.com and start your journey to better photos. Crazy to think about. Anyway, so let me get back on track here. So after, you know, these advancements in computational photography, more people now shoot with their phone, right? But because of that, more people then get interested in photography. And this could be your story as well. You had taken a lot of photos on your phone, maybe even some really good photos, and you thought, I love the photos that I can capture with my simple cell phone. I wonder how great they would be if I bought, you know, and invested in a real camera. So then you probably went out, you bought yourself a real camera, you get home, you start taking photos, and suddenly, you know, the whole world just comes crashing down. Like, wait, why do all of my photos look so boring and kind of blurry and shaky, you know, if I try to take a photo inside? They just don't look as good as I do with my cell phone. And again, that is because computational photography has done amazing things for mobile photography. But DSLRs, mirrorless cameras, professional grade cameras have truly been left behind in this changing world of photography. And why? Like, why is that? I was really interested because, again, just seeing all of the advancements that we have made with these teeny tiny sensors. I mean, I remember, I don't know how long ago it was. It was with the iPhone 5. So I don't know, 6 years ago, whatever it was, maybe 7 years ago. I remember that was the first time I was in my backyard and I looked up and I could see, you know, the constellation of Orion. And I just, for some reason, decided to pull out my phone and try to take a photo of it. And I did. And it showed up. And I remember thinking, what? Having, you know, had, you know, at this point, professional grade cameras, I knew that sensor size was really important to be able to capture low light. And if you look at the EXIF data on cell phone photos, it truly is like hilarious stuff. It's like, you know, a focal length of 2 millimeters, you know, an aperture of, I don't know, you know, 1.8 or whatever, shutter speed of 1/2827th of a second, and then an ISO of 418, you know, just some like ridiculous stuff. So I truly don't understand, you know, why settings are so different on cameras, except that because it's electronic, maybe there's just more preciseness that you can get at. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But I remember taking that photo and thinking to myself, like, this is a phenomenal leap forward. And that was 5 or 6 years ago, you know. So today, still knowing the physical limitations of cell phones and the physical advantages of having a DSLR, there's such a huge gap in the quality of photos that you can get straight out of camera. So when I started looking into, like, why has computational photography not come to DSLRs, mirrorless cameras, and professional grade cameras, you would think that these would be the first places that this would happen. And the simple answer is, what are the two largest mobile operating systems? They are iOS from Apple and then there's Android from Google. These two companies are at the pioneering front of computational photography. And both of these companies are two American companies. And yet the largest camera makers, what are they? They're Sony, they're Fuji, they're Canon, they're Nikon. All of these companies are based in Asian companies, or countries rather. And unfortunately, in doing some research, it appears as though in Asian countries, computer engineering isn't as, I guess, prestigious as a career, or at least as much as it is here in America, and therefore, not many people get into it. So engineering is big in, you know, other countries, and that is why camera makers can produce amazing things, tangible, physical things, even though they are electronic. Like, they can really make amazing things. So we're at the point now, but there's this disconnect where we're here in America, I guess value computer engineering as a society. Like, we see the benefit of it, whereas in Asian countries and other countries throughout the world just don't see it as much. And I don't know if that's because maybe there just aren't as many companies. I'm not going to speculate. I don't know. But regardless, we are at this point now to where cell phone cameras are physically far inferior to DSLRs, but technologically they are far superior than even the most professional cameras that we have today. They, you know, cell phones can shoot in very challenging light. They can produce beautiful colors. They can grab focus quick, and the images are pretty much always sharp. So that really begs the question of, like, what does that mean for all of us with a real camera? Because I think that this can be super discouraging when learning photography, because again, you have the cell phone, you just have it, right? You need a cell phone to call people and whatnot. And then you take photos every once in a while, and then you start to like it a lot. So then you start taking more and more photos, and then you decide to buy yourself a camera, a real camera, thinking, if I can get these photos with a cell phone, imagine what I can get with a real camera. You buy yourself that Canon, or you buy yourself that Nikon, you know, whatever camera. And then the learning curve is so steep compared to a cell phone. And I'm not just talking about, like, ease of use. It's about capturing just amazing images never before possible. Now, there's some good news. There are some camera manufacturers today who are trying to bring computational photography to dedicated cameras. Camera companies like, you know, Young Nuo, who is traditionally known for their budget 50mm clones lenses that they make for Canon, Nikon, I think maybe Sony. But then they also make a large range of flashes as well. So they're trying to get into the camera game, making a camera that runs Android. So if you were to get that, obviously it wouldn't be a phone. It'd be more of like a computer, right? But the point is, you would be able to attach your Canon lens or whatever, and then you could go out and shoot. And that would be a massive, massive step forward in photography, being able to take in all of that data, have the computer essentially that is your camera figure out where are the highlights, where are, you know, the shadows, what can we do to blend these exposures together, what can we do to, you know, just make this image the best that it can be. So it's a big step forward in that direction, but it is still a very, very far, you know, point from its full potential. And I think, like, if we were to think back to, like, the original iPhone, if I see somebody walking around with an original iPhone today, like, I'm embarrassed for them, right? Because, like, it's trash. It can't do anything except for, like, make calls and text people, which, I mean, when you think about the purpose of a phone, that's really all that you really need. But we just put more things into phones today. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But at the time when it was released, it changed the world. So it's the same thing. Like, today, if you put that technology in a camera, it's going to make a big splash, right? Because it's going to be able to do some amazing things right away. but it's still going to be so far off from what it will be able to do. You compare the iPhone 13 or whatever we got today versus the original iPhone, huge difference, but it takes time to get there. There was also the L16 camera, and I think that this was a Kickstarter camera. I can't remember, but it had it looked like a cell phone. It was just a big brick, and it had 16 lenses on it. And whenever you would take a photo, at least to my understanding, it would capture all of the data from all of the sensors, all 16 sensors, and then it would compile this amazing file, essentially, where you could, after the fact, choose a different focal length, a different aperture, a different focus point. Again, after you took the photo. And as somebody who personally has missed both focus and missed the moment of a first kiss, the ability to be able to rewind just half a second to get that photo and make it the best that it can be is a really exciting thought. Now, again, it's going to take time for this to take off because, you know, these calculations and adjustments are done in camera like they are on a phone instantly before you take the photo. That is going to take time because there's going to have to be some sort of blend. There's going to have to be some sort of investment from these camera makers to bring computational photography and the chips required and the software required and bring them into the, you know, into a camera body itself. But that doesn't mean that we just have to sit here today and wait for these things, because there are programs and apps that can kind of bridge that gap for the time being to be able to see what is possible. So if you are interested in this idea, it's possible to kind of start to dabble in all the things that computational photography will be able to do very easily, but kind of use that in your photography today. So over the past 3 years or so, maybe you've heard me talk about it, but there's this thing called an iPad, and it has become pivotal in my photography workflow today, mostly for just non-professional images, so like my personal images, and not because it's not capable of working on professional images. It's just that, you know, over the years, I have a system that is built around Lightroom Classic and moving everything over to Lightroom CC. I don't think it would provide any real-world benefits for my use, so I just leave all that on the computer. But anyway, for personal photos, the iPad has really, like I said, changed my photography workflow and how I capture, create, and even edit all those photos. And a large part of that is because there are some phenomenal photography apps. So the obvious is going to be, you know, Lightroom. Everybody's going to know and love Lightroom. There's also Snapseed. But then there's also an app called Focus, and it is spelled F-O-C-O-S, Focus. So what you do with this app is that you take a photo on your camera, like mirrorless DSLR camera, right? And then you load that photo from your camera into your iPad. And it can be a raw file, it can be a JPEG, whatever it is. But then you bring that file into the app. And then this app uses computational techniques, computational algorithms, I don't know, to scan the photo. And then it adds a depth chart to it. So it looks at the photo, figure out what is the closest thing to the frame, what is furthest away in this scene. And then it creates a depth chart. And then within that depth chart, you can make certain adjustments to different depths. So what does that mean? What can you do with that? Well, you could upload a portrait of maybe a bride just standing in a field. And you could use a depth chart to separate the bride from the background, right? So then you can now dim the whole background, but keep the bride lit properly without using something more generic, like just a vignette, or without having to manually brush the entire background. And you can just do it automatically based on that depth. And it really does feel like magic at times, honestly. It's super cool. There's a bit of a learning curve, but once you figure it out, it is a ton of fun to be able to get in there and mess around with some photos. So I recommend that you check out Focus, again, Focos, and just play around with it and see what you can do. You know, another thing that you could do is not remove, but, you know, sometimes you take a photo and there is some sort of distracting subject in your foreground. Maybe a kid walks in front of your lens, or, you know, some jerk walks in front of your lens, and you took a photo of your kid doing something really cute. And it's a good photo, but this person totally ruined the image by them walking, you know, right in front of your frame. Now, you could try to remove that in something like Photoshop, but that could take a lot of work depending on the type of photo. But with a depth map, the app Focus is going to figure out, oh, okay, this person walking in front of the lens is the closest thing to the lens. So now you can essentially make edits based on just that person's distance. And you could either blur them or make them more underexposed. Just some sort of trick so that the viewer doesn't pay as much attention to them, and then they give more attention to, you know, your kid doing that super cute, fun thing. Again, it's not going to remove the person from the frame, but again, if your kid is what is most important, most in focus here, less attention is going to be given to that jerk who walked right in front of you, and again, can increase the visual power of the photo that you took. So while it does use computational algorithms to help you make changes to a file, it can't change the original file, right? As I said, it's not going to remove that person in the frame. And that means that to get the best results, even when using computational photography, you still have to have a properly exposed image, you know, just a good file that comes out of camera. And where, you know, we are at today, the computational photography just adds a little extra touch of flavor to your image. So I think when it comes to the future of photography, when it comes to the future of computational photography in our cameras, I do think it's close. I think it's closer than we think, but it is not here today, you know, obviously. But when it catches on, I really think that it's going to just spread like wildfire, because the amount of new possibilities and options that you'll be able to have to create truly unique images is going to be amazing. But in that same sense, you know, that there are still photographers who still shoot using, you know, a almost 200-year-old method, there's always going to be room for the cameras that we have today, so don't ditch your camera to shoot exclusively on an iPhone until computational photography comes out. But I think the better of an understanding that you have of photography today, the better you will be prepared for when the change happens. Again, it's like shooting on your phone. If you shoot in poor light or a bad distance, or you photograph a boring moment, the photo can't be edited into greatness. But if you capture a great photo in camera, using your cell phone, good light, composition, moment, when you bring that photo into edit, you'll be able to achieve great results. So the past 28 minutes and 9 seconds, I guess I've just been trying to get to the point here to where I'm just trying to say, don't give up on photography today. In order to wait for computational photography, because it will come. But that doesn't mean stopping today is the best option. The harder that you work today, the better you're going to be set up for when, you know, these options become available to us. But I want to know what you think. When it comes to computational photography, when it comes to software and our photography, are you all in or all out when it comes to this sort of stuff? I would love to hear your thoughts in the Beginner Photography Podcast Facebook community. You can find it and join today by searching Facebook, obviously, for Beginner Photography Podcast. Or there is also a link to join the group on our homepage at beginnerphotographypodcast.com. So that is it for this week. I really hope that you learned something about photography, about computational photography, about the power that our cell phones have, and what it means for our real cameras going forward. But at the end of this, I do want you to remember that the more photos that you take today, the better of a photographer you will be tomorrow. Talk to you soon.